From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Terror in the Far West. According to James Grant, Iceland is rich in legends and traditional stories of ghostly phenomena. One of the most remarkable of the stories is the following. A lady of considerable means stated in her will that she wished to be buried in a spot far from where she lived. The person who inherited her property willfully disregarded her request. He told the undertaker to deposit her remains anywhere he chose. The undertaker did as he was bidden, and the coffin was buried close to the house in which the lady had died. After interring her remains, the undertaker and his men returned to the lady's house and were carousing there when her ghost, wrapped in a winding sheet, suddenly appeared and shook its clenched hand menacingly at them. Scared to death, they rushed out of the house and never returned to enter it again. A herdsman who had been with them in the house was found the next day dead in bed. A man named Thorold, who was a seer and an associate of the person who inherited the lady's estate, contacted the herdsman's ghost and died from fright. Poltergeist disturbances took place nightly in the house where the lady had dwelt. Furniture and kitchen utensils were flung about by invisible hands. Horrible figures pounced out on people from cupboards and dark corners. A phantom with a body resembling a seal and the head of a long-dead human corpse rose from the floor of the kitchen and frightened the people who saw it to such an extent that one of them died and another went mad. A boat mysteriously overturned on the river near the lady's house, and the three people in it were drowned. Their ghosts, the herdsman's ghost and Thorold's ghost, all haunted the lady's house and the neighboring village. People fled from the locality in terror. A priest finally summoned up the courage to visit the haunted house and the adjoining land and exorcise the ghost. The hauntings then ceased. Hauntings quite as terrifying as those in Iceland have occurred from time to time in and around a valley in the Indian territory of Tishomingo in the United States. Fighting between the invisible antagonists is heard in the air over the valley before any grave epidemic or serious trouble among the Indians. In May 1892, John Willis, a United States Marshal, was belated in the valley one night. He had not heard that it was haunted. He slept on a rock and was awakened by his horse stamping on the ground. He sprang up thinking that the horse was scared by coyotes. The valley was illuminated by the light of the full moon. He saw nothing but heard terrible noises in the air. Sounds of blows, cries of agony, pleadings for mercy, groans and thuds of stricken bodies. His horse was terrified and he was too frightened to move. He remained in one spot until the sound ceased, when he at once mounted and sped from the valley as fast as his horse could carry him. The following day a serious epidemic broke out in Tishomingo. Ghostly happenings of a somewhat similar kind are said to occur in the Canyon of the Lost Souls in Colorado. There are few ravines in the world that inspire one with greater awe. The sides of the ravine are broken and scarred as if some demon possessing titanic power had charged and struck them. According to a very old tradition, a company of Spanish soldiers who entered the somber ravine were never seen again. They were generally supposed to have been killed by the evil spirits that haunted the ravine. At nighttime, their cries of terror and agony can still be heard above the roaring of the river that rushes furiously through the gorge. In the early 90s of the last century, I visited Crater Lake in Oregon and camped out for several nights in the forest bordering it. I was immeasurably impressed by the sight of the lake and could hardly credit that the vast expanse of placid green water, which seemed to be so near to me, was more than 1,000 feet below the brink of the cliff on which I was standing. In those days, few tourists ever visited the lake, and it still bore a very eerie reputation. Backwoodsmen who had lived for many years in the forest and Indians belonging to the Rogue River Reservation told strange tales of ghostly happenings in the regions that were in close proximity to the lake. The Indians firmly believed that the lake was the abode of evil spirits that tempted people to throw themselves over the cliffs. One of these spirits was a female phantom of far greater beauty than the lovely Pocahontas, daughter of Powhatan, who rescued Captain John Smith when her father was on the point of killing him. If this beautiful spirit encountered a solitary young man in the region of Crater Lake, she smiled invitingly at him. Few youths could look at her without succumbing to her charms. Her eyes enthralled them. They made violent love to her, and directly they kissed her lovely, enticing lips, their doom was fixed. She reciprocated their passion for a time and then led them to the lake and told them to leap into it, enfolded in her caressing arms. This they did without a protest, and their souls passed forever into the keeping of the diabolical spirits of Crater Lake. Another the ghost said to haunt the neighborhood of the lake was a black stag. It magnetically attracted all men who saw it and compelled them to chase it to the lake. On arriving there, it leaped into the distant water, and the men who had followed it leaped after it always to their death. The lake, I am told, is still reputed to be haunted. The Devil's Pool, a basin 150 feet wide, worn in the rock of the White Mountains, New Hampshire, was reputed to be haunted long before white man landed in America. The first time that white men visited the White Mountains, the Indians warned them not to linger near the Devil's Pool, and assured them, should they dally there, they would see phantoms of such terrible shapes that they would either die from fright or become raving mad. Now the White Mountains attract crowds of tourists every summer, but notwithstanding their presence, some of the terrifying spirits are rumored to hover around the pool and hills even yet. Very weird and extraordinary tales are told of the Lone Rocks in Monument Park, Colorado. These rocks are stone pillars, or columns of varying heights crowned with wide flat boulders that are not unlike broad-brimmed bats. Seen in the moonlight, the grotesqueness of these pillars is liable to have a very scaring effect on people who are at all imaginative. Like some of the ancient tribes in Asia and Europe, the Red Indians of America believed that every mountain, rock, river, tree, and cave harbored a spirit. They declared that the lone rock pillars emitted gruesome blue lights at night, and out of them emerged fantastic figures that danced about in the moonlight and took a fiendish delight in frightening and living creature that came near them. Two tourists who visited the rocks about the beginning of the present century were making fun of their queer crowns when one of the tourists felt a violent blow on his back. He turned quickly round but saw no one. That night he was taken suddenly ill and died. The Indians and the old settlers in Colorado believed that anyone who laughed at the lone rocks was sure to experience grave misfortune within the next 24 hours. A haunted family. In the Old Argosy of 1879, there's an account of a very harrowing family haunting in Canada. Miss Anne Duquesne and her sister Louise were spending the summer with her friends, the Whitakers, who lived on the outskirts of Montreal. The Whitaker family consisted of Major Whitaker, his two sisters, and their niece Lucy, who was a very pretty, smart young girl. The Laurels, where the Whitakers lived, was a long, low, rambling building. It was situated about 50 yards from the main road to Montreal. Two large wooden gates led to a broad, winding gravel drive, which was edged on each side with laurel bushes. In front of the house was a wide, well-kept lawn, and in the rear an exclusive garden, orchard, and fields. The front door of the house was made of oak. It was very old and weather-stained. On it were marks which showed the place that was formerly occupied by a large iron knocker. For some peculiar reason, the knocker had been removed. There was only now a wire bell. Major Whitaker, who had always been very lively and sociable, had recently become very religious and taciturn. One evening, his niece and the Duquesnes were about to go for a walk when he sternly forbade them to leave the house. He told them that a bad storm was brewing. The sky was then quite clear, but it soon darkened. The wind moaned and whistled round the old house, and the rain beat against the windows. The storm became more and more violent. Windows rattled, doors jarred, and the rain came down in torrents. Very gradually, the fury of the storm abated, and calmness reigned once again. The stillness was presently broken by the sound of a heavy carriage coming along the drive at a furious rate. The three girls, who wondered who would be coming to the house at so late an hour, it was nearly 10 o'clock, went to the front door and were about to look out when Major Whitaker dragged them back. He shut the door and locked and bolted it. He had hardly done so when the carriage stopped outside the house, and the next moment there was a violent knocking as if with an iron knocker. Major Whittaker, who was greatly agitated, bade everyone in the house kneel down in the hall while he prayed to be delivered from the evil spirits that haunted his family. By degrees, the knocking grew fainter and finally ceased. The three girls, who had been terrified during the knocking, ran into the room in which they all slept and peered out of the window. It no longer rained, and the drive and lawn were bathed in moonlight. There was no sign of the phantom carriage. In the morning, Mr. Lefroy, a friend of Major Whittaker, came to the house. On being told about the ghostly knocking, he examined the carriage drive and found traces of a heavy vehicle and hoof marks in the gravel. He and the Major's sister strongly advised the Duquesnes to terminate their visit and leave the house as soon as possible. They arranged to go the following day and wanted to take Lucy with them, but her aunt said, "She must stay. She is one of us and must learn to endure the ghostly happenings in our family with the same fortitude as we and our forebears have always endured them." That night, Anne Duquesne was awakened by her sister, who pointed in terror at the door. It was opening very slowly, and the two girls saw a tall hooded figure in a long flowing garment silently into the room with long monkish strides. When it was halfway across the floor, it turned and looked at Louise with evil gleaming eyes. She murmured a prayer, and after remaining stationary for a few moments, still regarding her fixedly, it gradually faded away. The Duquesnes roused Lucy, and the three girls remained awake with a candle burning until the morning. After breakfast, Anne and Louise packed their things, and accompanied by Lucy Whittaker, went for a final stroll in the lovely old-world gardens in the rear of the house. They were walking along one of the paths that intersected it when they were suddenly conscious of someone following them. Lucy and Louise felt a cold hand touch them. They screamed, turned around, and froze. The hooded figure, which they had seen in the night, confronted them. It did not look at Anne, but at Lucy and Louise. Anne at once crossed herself and uttered a prayer, whereupon the apparition wheeled round and strode silently away, disappearing from view round a bend in the path. They ran to the house and told the eldest Miss Whittaker that they had seen the horrible ghost in the garden. "So long as it did not stare at you or touch you," she said, "no harm will befall you." "It touched me," Louise said. "And me," Lucy added. Miss Whittaker sighed deeply and told the girls not to let what happened worry them too much. Lucy asked if there was anything in the past that might account for the hauntings. She shook her head. "I don't know," she said. "There may be." The Duquesnes left the Laurels later in the day. Within a few weeks, Louise fell ill and died, and Lucy met with a fatal accident. Some months after her death, Major Whittaker died. His sisters shut the house and moved elsewhere. The Ghost of Whooping Hollow. Few places in the United States of America were for many years worse haunted than Whooping Hollow in New England. Two reasons have been suggested for the curious name of the famous valley. One of them is the following. Centuries ago, Wyandanch, a famous Indian warrior, fought a great battle with a rival tribe. After the battle, in which he lost many of his men, he was secretly followed by his home by a magician who employed evil spirits to torment and injure him. Wyandanch's faithful followers waged war against the magician and besieged him in his den in Whooping Valley. He appealed to his familiars to aid him, uttering the peculiar piercing whooping cry that he always made when he summoned them. But instead of coming to his assistance, they betrayed him and showed his assailants the secret entrance to his den. They burst in upon him and slew and scalped him. Because of the extraordinary cry he uttered, Wyandanch's tribesmen called the valley the Whooping Hollow, the name by which it was henceforth known. After the magician's death, his ghost and his familiars haunted Whooping Hollow, terrifying and seriously harming all who saw or heard them. The other reason that has been suggested for the odd name of the hollow is probably better known. In the early years of the last century, there was living within a few miles of the hollow a prosperous farmer of British extraction. His eldest son, a clever, good-looking boy in his teens, left home one morning in the fall of the year to go to school. To get there, he had to walk through the hollow. He never reached the school. No one testified to seeing him after he left his home. His shoes and handkerchief, stained with blood, were found in a thicket in the hollow, but his body was never discovered. It was generally believed that he had been murdered by a band of Indians who had been causing considerable trouble in the neighborhood. Late one afternoon, 20 years after the mysterious murder of the farmer's son, a horseman, accompanied by two big dogs, stopped at an inn a few miles from the hollow and ordered a meal. While he was eating, he chatted with the landlord, who advised him on no account to go through Whooping Hollow on his way to his destination. The horseman, who was a stranger in that part of New England, wanted to know the landlord's reason for wanting him to avoid Whooping Hollow. The landlord then told him about the murder, and said that the hollow was haunted by very evil and dangerous spirits, that people who had entered it alone after nightfall had died from fright or become gibbering maniacs. He also explained that the valley was called the Whooping Valley because of the extraordinary noise that was made by the ghost of the murdered boy. The traveler laughed and declared that it would take more than a ghost to scare him. Having paid for his meal, he mounted his steed and disregarded the landlord's warning, aimed for Whooping Hollow. The route along which he traveled was for some distance tolerably smooth and level, but it gradually became very rough and uneven. His horse stumbled several times and almost unseated him, while to add to his difficulties, the young moon was constantly obscured by heavy clouds. When it was visible, its pale light enabled him to see that the track, it could hardly be termed a road, led precipitously down into a profound and rugged valley, which he thought must be the alleged badly haunted Whooping Hollow. He scanned the scene attentively and distinctly saw the dark green tops of many trees waving in the cool night breeze. His horse was very reluctant to descend the steep path that led into the distant hollow. No sound broke the silence except the tramping of his horse's feet and the faint pattering of the dogs. So deep was the valley that even the wind, which had swept in occasional great gusts over the surface of the plateau that he had just left, could hardly be felt. The descent seemed interminable, but he at length reached the bottom of the gloomy chasm. The moon, which suddenly shone with great brilliance, revealed a wild and rugged scene. The track abruptly widened, and on either side of it he could discern fantastically fashioned trunks of trees, and in between them large, queer-shaped masses of stone that gleamed a ghostly white in the moonlight. The silence that had hitherto been so profound was now broken by the noise made by a stream as swollen by recent rain, it swept furiously through the valley. The horseman had reached the point where the stream intersected the track and was spanned by a wide wooden bridge, when he fancied he saw something large moving through the uncertain gloom. He observed it more closely and perceived to his surprise that it was a boy, who was without a hat and carried in one hand something like a bundle or satchel. He was on the other side of the stream, about 30 yards ahead of the horseman, and walking in the same direction. The horseman crossed the bridge and urged the steed forward with the intention of overtaking the youthful pedestrian. To his astonishment, no matter how fast his horse went, the distance between him and the boy remained the same. The boy never seemed to alter his pace, but kept advancing with the same unvarying, deliberate strides. The horseman called out, "What ho! Who are you?" The boy did not reply or evince by any gesture the slightest consciousness of the horseman's presence. The horseman repeated the salutation and again tried to overtake the boy, but with the same result. The distance between them remained the same. The horseman began to feel nervous. Why no reply? He wondered. Was the boy deaf? And why could he not overtake the boy? He suddenly realized that although the boy was only a short distance ahead of him and was traveling over similarly rough, rocky ground, his steps made no noise. To make certain, the horseman stopped his horse, held his breath, and listened very intently, but he could hear no sounds except the gurglings and splashings of the swift-flowing stream. His dogs, although usually fearless and very high-spirited, lagged behind him, whining and apparently badly scared. His horse trembled violently and was more and more reluctant to proceed. The obvious terror experienced by the animals infected the horseman. In spite of his skepticism, he felt a superstitious fear stealing fast over him. It increased immeasurably when it suddenly dawned on him that what he had thought was a boy, a creature of flesh and blood like himself, was not of this world at all, but a ghost. The surrounding silence seemed no longer natural, but unearthly, and eager to hear any sound that was accountable, he shouted again. The sound of his voice, thus exerted in the utter solitude, and followed by a stillness broken only by the turbulent stream, had in it something so uncannily thrilling that he did not dare to shout again. The apparition, which still maintained the same distance ahead of him, now entered a thicket and was no longer visible. A few minutes after it had vanished from sight, there was a cry, or rather a whoop, followed almost immediately by a yell of agony and frightful screams and groans. These sounds were succeeded by peals of diabolical laughter and whooping. The horseman's steed, mad with terror, dashed along the track, narrowly avoiding collision with the gaunt boulders that stood in its way. The poor frightened hounds tried in vain to keep up with it. It had continued its mad career over little distance when it swerved from the track so abruptly that the horseman was almost unseated. He was wondering what had startled the animal when the apparition that had entered the thicket suddenly emerged from behind a tree. The moonlight, focusing on its face, revealed the livid, horribly mutilated face of a corpse. A gruesome greenish-yellow light enveloped the entire body. The dreadful thing spread out its fleshless arms and, with a ghastly grin, uttered a blood-curdling whoop. It then vanished. The long, reverberating echo of the cry had hardly ceased when a violent storm arose. The angry wind roared and howled among the trees, whose branches swayed and bent before the blasts. The thunder roared and the lightning flashed. The horseman, drenched to the skin in the pouring rain, emerged from the whooping hollow feeling more dead than alive, but extremely thankful to be free of ghosts and once again in the open country. A Ghost Embraces. A strange story of a man's ghastly experience in a mortuary was told me by an elderly physician when I was in Boston. The body of a woman was found one night floating in a river and was taken to the mortuary of a small New England town. It was placed on a table and covered with a sheet. The night watchman was so accustomed to seeing corpses in various stages of decomposition that he did not mind sharing the room with them even in the dark. He leaned casually against the table on which this particular corpse had been deposited, and to while away the time, he hummed a tune. When he had hummed it several times, he began to think that the friend who had promised to pay him a visit was a long time coming. The night seemed unusually still, and he became more and more uneasy. He tried not to think of the dark, swollen river and the corpse on the table behind him, too close to be pleasant. He had only given it a casual glance before covering it with a sheet, but he remembered now that there had been something rather disturbingly unusual about it. As it was a moonlit night, the gas was low. He was about to turn it on higher when it suddenly went out. Thinking it very strange, as there was no draught, he struck a match and found the gas had been turned off. Unable to explain how this could have happened, and somewhat perturbed, he lit the gas, and keeping it rather higher than it had been previously, he returned to a seat by the table. He had not been sitting long before the gas went out again, and something moved very softly and stealthily past him. He was more than a little startled. His heart almost stopped beating. He felt sick and faint, and would have escaped from the building had he had the power to do so, but his strength had left him, and he felt, as one feels in a nightmare, all weighted down, weak and helpless, unable to move a limb. He would have shrieked, but his tongue clove to the roof of his mouth. Presently his terror reached its climax. The footsteps crept nearer and nearer towards him. Something icily cold touched one of his hands and felt its way up his body to his throat. The something was behind him. It bent over him. He was in the arms of the corpse. Overtaxed nature gave way at last. He uttered a piercing shriek and fell in a swoon upon the floor. In that condition he was found by his friend. His experience might have been attributed to a nightmare or overheated imagination had it not been for damp and slimy marks on his clothes and muddy footprints on the floor. The feet of the corpse, which had been in the river fully a week before it was brought to the mortuary, corresponded exactly to the footprints. Fantastic and dangerous spirits. The folklore and ghost lore of many countries contains accounts of phenomena that are an odd mixture of ghost and fairy. In Touraine, there existed until comparatively recently a belief in brews. A brew is a phenomenon that is a human being during the daytime and a sheep during the night. It derives its name from the American term for a thicket, because brews are supposed to gallop all night through woods and thickets. A man walking along a road in the near vicinity of St. Quentin one night found a small sheep that apparently strayed from the flock and seemed to be lost. He picked the animal up and was on his way home with it when it asked him in a human voice where he was taking it. He was so terrified that he dropped the brew, which at once turned into a woman who bounded away, uttering peals of diabolical laughter. She proved to be a married woman whose name was in Liege. As soon as it was known that she was a Brew, she had to leave Liege. What subsequently became of her was never certain. Brews were sometimes very distinctive. They ran over the country at night, killing and devouring dogs, poultry, and occasionally little children. About the year 1832, a man who was suspected of being a dangerous Brew was shot at St. Hippolyte near Laux. A young man named Charles Robin, a small farmer, on going into his garden one fine moonlit night, saw a small sheep walking along a path. Directly he approached it, it bounded over a high wall and dashed into an adjacent forest, uttering the most unearthly laughter. Robin called his uncle, who ran into the garden and also heard the laughter, which clearly proved the sheep was a Brew. Brews were said to laugh evilly when any attempt was made to capture or even to approach them. A white phantom known as La Milleraine, or Demoiselle, was said to haunt Touraine. It was of enormous stature, and although of no definite form, was believed to be feminine. It appeared in lonely places and portended grievous trouble to whoever saw it. A very unpleasant species of goblin was believed in the last century to haunt houses in Normandy. It played very troublesome and mischievous tricks, knocking at doors, moving furniture about, pulling the bedclothes off people, and making hideous faces at children. The most obnoxious and terrifying of these goblins was called La Bête de Saint-Germain. Believed in Maras was more widespread than belief in Brews, which was confined to northern and western France. A Mara was a human being, generally a woman, in the daytime, and at night an evil spirit that tormented people and horses by sitting on them and making them have the most horrible nightmares. Credulity in these phenomena existed in Scandinavia up to the present century. The following is one of numerous recorded cases of Maras in Jutland. One evening, some reapers in a village in Jutland found a naked woman lying under a hedge in a field. Considerably surprised, they regarded her very closely, and coming at length to the conclusion that her sleep was not natural, they summoned a shepherd, who was generally regarded as very intelligent. On seeing the woman, he said at once, "She is not a real woman, although she seems like one. She is a Mara, and has stripped for the purpose of riding someone tonight." At this, there were shouts of laughter, and one of the reapers said, "Tell us another, Christian. A Mara, indeed. This person is not a real woman. Our mothers are not real women." "All right," Christian replied, "wait and see." Bending over her, he whispered in her ear, whereupon a queer little creature came out of the grass, and running up to her, disappeared in her mouth. Christian gave her a push. She rolled over three times, sprang to her feet, and with a wild, startled cry, leaped over a high bush and vanished. The reapers hurried home, convinced that Christian had spoken the truth, and that the naked person really was a wicked Mara. Belief in black elves existed in Great Britain up to at least the 18th century. Among the people said to possess the rare faculty of seeing this phenomena was Cattell, a pious rustic who lived at Farnham in Yorkshire. The historian William of Newbury relates the following anecdote about Cattell. While but a lad, Cattell was returning home one day from harvesting, riding on a wagon horse, when suddenly in a place perfectly level and smooth, the horse stumbled as though it had met with an obstacle, and Cattell was thrown to the ground. As he raised himself up, he beheld two very small black elves, who were laughing most lustily at the trick that they had played upon him. From that hour was given to him the power of seeing elves wherever they might be and whatever they might be doing, and he often saved people from their malice. He assured those people who were fortunate enough to gain his confidence, for he did not tell these things to everybody, that there was some hobgoblins who were large and strong and who were capable of doing much hurt to those who might fall into their power, but that others were very small and contemptible, incapable of doing much harm, and very stupid and foolish, but who delighted in tormenting and teasing mankind. He said that he often saw them sitting by the roadside on the lookout for travelers upon whom to play their tricks, and laughing in high glee when they could cause either them or their horses to stumble, particularly when the rider, irritated by his steed, spurred and beat it well after the accident. Cattell, as might be supposed, drew upon himself, by his officiousness and by his power of seeing the elves and hobgoblins, the hatred of the whole of their fraternity. The English chronicler John of Brompton tells of the capture of a black elf by the abbot of a monastery, who kept it clad in a monkish robe in the monastery, until someone took the garment from it, when it vanished at once and was never seen again. And his book, The Norse Folk, or A Visit in the Homes of Norway and Sweden, Mr. Charles Loring Brace mentions some of the superstitions prevalent in those countries. One of the superstitions is about trolls. Trolls are a very dangerous species of elves. According to Mr. Brace, they always dance on Christmas morning between cock-crowing and the break of day. In an old castle in the south of Sweden, Mr. Brace was shown a drinking horn and a little ivory whistle which was alleged to have come into the possession of the family through a strange circumstance. According to a traditionary story, there was once near the castle a boulder which was haunted every night by a number of trolls who used to dance around it. The old lady who lived in the castle offered a large sum of money to anyone who would go to the boulder and find out if the rumors about the haunting were true. At first, no one ventured to go, but finally a young huntsman volunteered. Shortly before cock-crowing, he rode to the boulder. When he drew near it, he heard the sound of music and dancing and saw the boulder raised up on golden pillars and bright lights underneath it. Round and under the boulder were a host of trolls dancing, singing, and drinking. Their queen wore a diamond crown and had a little whistle in her hand. Seeing the huntsman, she ran towards him and welcomed him. She was so beautiful that he fell violently in love with her and was about to drink out of the horn which one of her retainers handed to him when someone, whom he could not see, told him in a low voice that if he drank any of the liquor in the horn, he would straightway forget everything in his past life and become transformed forever into a troll. He at once poured the contents of the horn on the ground, snatched the whistle from the queen, and rode away. Some of the liquor in the horn fell on his horse and scorched its hide. The trolls pursued him, cursing and shrieking. As he approached the castle, he found the portcullis down and the old lady and her retainer standing waiting for him. He knew that if he could get over the moat in front of the castle, he would be safe, because witches and evil spirits could not cross water. Galloping furiously, he reached the moat bridge just in time. The trolls stood on the brink of the moat and begged the huntsman to give them back the horn and whistle. The queen of the trolls offered countless diamonds and heaps of gold for them, but the old lady of the castle refused to restore them. Thereupon, the queen of the trolls said that if the old lady persisted in keeping the horn and whistle, she must guard them very carefully, for should they be at any time removed from the castle would be burnt down. The old lady said, "Be gone, evil creatures, in the holy name be gone." Whereupon all the trolls vanished, but for years afterwards, even up to the time Mr. Brace visited the castle, the trolls were believed to haunt it. The horn and whistle were removed from the castle 3 times, and on each occasion, the castle was burnt down. The family that owned it finally died out, and their successors kept the horn and whistle in the glass case in which Mr. Brace saw them. A noble family in Sweden, the trolls derived their name from the daring deed of one of their ancestors, who sliced off the head of a troll queen who offered him magic drink in her horn. This horn was long preserved in a Swedish cathedral. Troll queens invariably lured men whom they could not charm to violent and painful deaths. Mr. Brace states that when he was in Sweden, he was frequently summoned to see or hear the spokeri. They were evil spirits who fought and threw things at one another. They sometimes attacked and scared to death horses and cattle. The spokeri are as hideous as they are evil. They have had the heads of skeletons and scaly bloated bodies. Belief in them still exists in parts of Sweden and other Scandinavian countries. The Shapeless Horror near Braemar. John Grant in his Legends of the Braemar says the Rock of the Ghosts near Braemar was haunted for many years by a black, loathsome, shapeless, monstrous, woolly, evil spirit which used to hurl stones at anyone who tried to ascend the rocky hill. The cries and yells which it uttered were so dreadful that all who heard them were terrified. No one in Braemar dared to pass near the hill after nightfall. The dread of the monster was so great that the people of Braemar besought John Avignon, on account of his diminutive stature, was known as the Sagart Beg, or the little priest, to lay it. He'd climb boldly, unmolested, to the top of the ghost of the rock and said mass, and then force the haunting ceased. The horrible spirit that had for so long haunted the rocky hill and caused such widespread terror was never seen or heard again. John Grant, in the same book, mentions the Witch of Glengarm, the Thunderbolt Carline. Before she became a witch, she was a young and happy wife. Her husband and 7 of her sons were killed in battle. Her only remaining boy was deformed. After her losses, she seemed to have devoted herself to prophecy and witchcraft, in both of which she acquired considerable notoriety. Beyond vainly attempting, through her magical powers, to change the course of the River Don, with the idea of making it flow through Morven instead of through Strathdon and Strathdee, she never seems to have striven for anything at all mischievous or harmful. Yet people held her in awe and declared that a copse near her house was haunted by evil spirits that wrought great mischief. The ruins of her home, which was also said to be haunted, were to be seen as recently as the middle of the last century, possibly even later. The Monster of the Moor Mound. J.G. Campbell gives the following account of a murderous semi-human, semi-spirit phenomenon in his book Witchcraft and Second Sight in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. On the shore and forming part of the boundary between North and South Morar, on the west coast of Inverness, is a large rocky mound which for many years was very badly haunted. The few people who ventured near it alone after nightfall were invariably found dead and shockingly mangled in the morning. Living in South Morar, not far from the haunted mound, was a man named MacDonnell, whose son and heir was a strong, courageous youth of 18 years of age. One evening, MacDonnell was visited unexpectedly by a man of considerable importance in the southwest of Scotland. It so happened that just when there was no one in the neighborhood of South Morar who could help MacDonnell entertain so distinguished a guest, so he told his son to go to Bracara and invite certain of his friends there to stay with him for a day or two. He strictly enjoined his son not to return alone that night for fear of the ghost. The young man set out on his mission at once. He passed the haunted mound, which was on the road to Bracara, without molestation, and arrived safely at his destination. The people whom he was instructed to invite were unfortunately unable to return with him, and as he could find no one else willing to accompany him, he was obliged to start on his homeward journey alone. Early in the morning, his dead body was found close to the haunted mound, horribly mutilated. Around it were traces of a desperate struggle. When MacDonnell learned about his son's death, he swore that he would avenge him. Regardless of the warnings of his friends and relatives, he went alone one night to the haunted mound. He had not been there long before he saw a tall, naked, hairy, headless figure that came out from behind the rock and said, "You have come to take your son's ransom. Be wise and go home." MacDonnell, in response, seized the apparition, and a furious struggle ensued. After it had gone on for a few minutes, MacDonnell managed to draw his dirk and was about to use it when his opponent cried, "Hold your hand, MacGluff. Touch me not with iron, and while there is one within the 20th degree related to you, I will not be seen again." MacDonnell stayed his hand and found he was grasping air. His sanguinary opponent had suddenly and inexplicably vanished. His account of his extraordinary combat was widely credited, not only in the neighborhood of its alleged occurrence, but throughout the land. Mr. Campbell says that shortly before he wrote his book, belief in the haunting even yet prevailed, and that people attributed its non-recurrence to the fact that some of MacDonald's relatives were still living. Another wild traditional story in which there's a jumble of the physical with the ghostly is associated with the ghost in grounds of Balcony in Cromarty. In close proximity to the grounds of Balcony House, there's a deep and narrow gorge through which the River Algran pursues a winding rocky course. Owing to its savage, gloomy character and rumors of strange, unaccountable happenings on the banks of the river and the bridge over it, the gorge has long borne a sinister reputation. Writing about the gorge in his statistical accounts of the parish of Balcony, Dr. Robertson says, "The observer, if he can look on the gulf below without any uneasy sensation, will be gratified by a view equally awful and astonishing. The wildness of the steep and rugged rocks, the gloomy horror of the cliffs and caverns inaccessible to mortar tread and where the genial rays of the suns never penetrate, the waterfalls which are heard pouring down in different places of the precipice, with sounds various in proportion to their distances, the hoarse and hollow murmuring of the river, which runs at the depth of 130 feet below the surface of the earth, the fine grove of pines which majestically climbs the sides of the beautiful eminence that rises immediately from the brink of the chasm. All these objects cannot be contemplated without exciting emotions of wonder and admiration in the mind of every beholder. The traditional story is as follows. About the middle of the 17th century, the Laird of Balcony returned home from a rather long absence with a beautiful young wife. She was singularly reserved and never alluded to her family or her pre-marriage days. She shunned society and used to bramble in places where there was little likelihood of her encountering anyone. The gorge of the Au Grand seemed to have a great attraction for her. It was in its immediate vicinity that she spent hours every day. A sudden change came over her. She grew less reserved and much more sociable, no longer shunning all her husband's acquaintances. But there was a mysterious wildness about her which inspired everyone who came in contact with her with a feeling of fear and apprehension. She seemed to be a creature of another world, not wholly human. One evening she set out to the gorge accompanied by one of her maids, a pretty simple Highland girl, to whom she had become curiously attached. It was dusk when they reached the gorge. The only sound that they could hear was the murmuring of the distant river. "Let us approach nearer the edge," said the lady, speaking for the first time since she had left the house. "No, no, not any nearer, madam," the girl cried. "The gully is haunted. Strange lights and shapes have been seen in it after nightfall." "Pshaw," the lady exclaimed. "How can you believe such stories? Come with me. I will show you a path which leads right down to the river." She seized the girl and dragged her, despite her struggles, towards the edge of the chasm. "You must come with me," she screamed. "There is no escape for you." "Suffer me, lady, to accompany you," a strong masculine voice said. "Your surety, madam, must be a willing one." A dark man in green suddenly appeared by the side of the lady, who immediately removed her hands from the girl, and with an expression of passive despair allowed the stranger to lead her to the brink of the gorge. She turned round on reaching the precipice and, taking a bunch of household keys from her belt, threw them to the maid. The keys struck a granite boulder and left on it an impression which is there to this day. The girl stood rooted to the ground with terror and amazement. When she cast a timid look around her to see what had become of the lady and the man in green, there was no sign of them. On returning to Balcony House, she told her strange story. A search for the lady was commenced at once, but although it was prolonged for several days, it proved to be fruitless. Not a trace of the lady and the man in green could be found anywhere. 10 years after her mysterious disappearance, a middle-aged Highlander named Donald, when searching in the gorge for a basket of fish which he had lost, came to an immense cavern. 2 huge dogs rose from their beds when they saw him, yawned lazily, and to his relief lay down without attempting to attack him. Behind them was an iron table, and on it the basket of fish which he had lost. Seated on an iron chair by the table was a lady of Balcony, who had so mysteriously disappeared. Donald begged her to return to her home. She told him that she was fixed to the chair and that no one could ever free her. Donald looked at the chair and saw that it was fastened to the rocky wall of the cavern and that the lady was chained securely to it. She besought him to leave at once and threw food to the dogs, which were eyeing him menacingly, in order to keep them quiet while he made his escape. He took his basket, bade her goodbye, and left the cave unharmed. He emerged from the gorge after a long and dangerous scramble among the rocks, rendered slippery in places by the spray from the river, and arrived home safely. Although many attempts were made by people living in the neighborhood of the gorge to find the cave and liberate the Lady of Balcony, they all failed. The Lady of Balcony was never seen by mortal eyes again. Presumably, through having broken some kind of compact which she had made with the devil, either he or one of his friends in the guise of the dark man in green had seized her. What a terrible fate to be glued forever to a rusty iron chair in a cold, damp cave. It only shows how very unwise it is to have any kind of dealings with a devil. He is sure to get the better of one in the end. Absurdly fantastic as is this traditional story of the Lady of Balcony, it is hardly more so than many of the stories of witches and sorcerers in which there was once a widespread belief, not only in Scotland, but in all parts of the world.